This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Aziz Sanjar grew up in a small town in Turkey, went to medical school, returned to his hometown, practiced medicine. After a while, he left for the U.S. and entered a Ph.D. program in Dallas to study molecular biology. And that is where he began his work on DNA that would lead to his sharing a Nobel Prize for Chemistry many decades later. He wanted to understand how cells could repair DNA that had been damaged by ultraviolet light. Nobel Prize winner Aziz Sanjar is a professor of biochemistry and biophysics at UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine and joins me now on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us about growing up. You came from a small town named Savar in 1946. Locate that for us. Where is that in Turkey?
It's a small farming town, and everybody make their living farming, and we grew vegetables, fruits, and poplar for export, and that.
Did you have to help out on the farm?
I did, and I did not like it.
You didn't like it?
No.
Now, how many brothers and sisters?
Eight brothers and sisters from my mother, and I had two half-brothers.
So you could hide out. There's 10 kids around. You could duck out in the barn. Nobody knew where you were.
No, father would catch us.
Okay. So what? So we know you didn't like farm work. What were your aspirations early on?
My father was very hardworking. He's the hardest working person I've ever known. So he was role modeling in that regard for hard work. Mother also raised eight children, and she was hardworking too, but she had a good appreciation for education. She insisted that all her kids get education, and she basically said, I don't want you to be farmers like your father. I want you to get an education and do something else. Farming is hard work.
They were raised at a time of big transition for Turkey.
Right.
Were they educated themselves?
No, they were not. When they were growing up, there were no schools in my part of the country. And so I think it is a great success of Atatürk's revolution and of the Republic that the remote part of Turkey, then when I was growing up, had schools, had outstanding teachers. And therefore, I got outstanding elementary and middle school education in Savar.
I think that's a little-known story in this country, the success of Atatürk in revolutionizing that country. And at least in that period, becoming a model for multiculturalism, for the rights of women, and for an education, as you say. I mean, in that period, things happen, you know, over time, we know, but it was a remarkable revolution.
It was, and not just in terms of education, like you said, in multiculturalism and equal rights for all. And this may sound a little...
Go ahead and say it.
I'll say it. For religious people, Muslim, maybe a little too much, but my mother was very religious woman, and she practiced Islam like anyone, but she worshipped Allah, and then she worshipped Atatürk. Because she realized what he had done for the country and for women, because he really made a point of giving women equal rights and emphasizing girls' education. And he was successful during his lifetime.
During his lifetime, yeah. And I think that's, again, a story that's too little told in a primarily Muslim country,
right,
where that success. And, of course, you then, again, one of the beneficiaries of that success, because good education was now reaching into rural areas. You get a good education. When did you decide to move on and to get a degree and move into medicine?
So in my second year of high school, mm-hmm. I had an excellent chemistry teacher, and that hooked me up on chemistry. After that, I decided to become chemist. And, of course, growing up in that part of the world, like all kids age group 6 to 18, what have you, you're a sports fan, and that part of the world, sports meant soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And so soccer was the other part of my life, and so I loved soccer, and I also liked education. And so in high school, I did well in my classes, but I also was very good goalkeeper, and both on my high school soccer team as well as an amateur soccer club. And I was called for the for trial for Turkey under 18 national team, and considered seriously, but I decided I was not tall enough to be really to succeed in eventually becoming the goalkeeper of the Turkish national soccer team, because that was my dream. And I realized that I'd never be, and so said, okay, well, concentrate on education.
You decided to hit the books. Well, I think we're all fortunate that that little trick of genetics gave us a Nobel Prize winner in such an important field. So tell us what happened next then in terms of pursuing your education.
So after graduating from high school, we take entrance exams to enter universities, and at the time I was going to university, each discipline gave entrance exam and their field. So medical school, engineering, chemistry, etc. gave entrance exam separately, and I was just going to take the chemistry entrance exam, but I had very close friends who want to be doctors and took the medical entrance exam, and they sort of forced me to, said, you know, we've been together, let's take that too. So I took both and did well in both, and I was qualified for both, and then with peer pressure, I end up going to medical school.
You know, for most guys, peer pressure means drinking beer and using drugs. But for you, it means going to med school. This is a pretty incredible story. So you do, and you did pretty well, right? You finished top of your class.
Yes, I did.
620 in Istanbul, a very, very big city. So top of your class in that city. Pretty good.
I did. And I think partly because I was a good student, but partly it was fear, because I come, you said, from a remote part of Turkey, and here I was competing with kids from the best high schools in Istanbul and Ankara, and I was afraid I wouldn't be able to compete with them. So I studied as hard as you can. And I finished number one in my class of 625, but I did not enjoy Istanbul, which is, in my opinion, the world's most beautiful city. For example, Topkapı Museum, which is a World Heritage place, I was walking by it daily. And I never even knew it was there till I graduated from medical school. And there is also Topkapı District, which is outside Istanbul. And I always thought it was there. And so when I graduated, I said, well, I'll finally visit Topkapı Museum. I take the bus, it takes me out of the city, and I was told it's not here. And anyhow, so...
And Istanbul, by the way, not only is, I think, is a population in the millions, 16, 17 million people, geographically it's huge. It spans two continents. So to be in the wrong district, to take the bus out of Istanbul, is to be, you know, halfway to Greece. halfway to right. Syria. But so you're there, and that's not much else of a social life, too. Not only were you not visiting museums, but you weren't out dancing and playing.
No. I just studied. That was it.
Well, you did well, and you finished medical school, and you went home. Did you go right back to your hometown?
I practiced for 2 years as a village doctor. For 6 months, actually, I ran free clinic. Mm. And because my goal was to come to the United States after practicing, and I said, I'm from this part of the country. I serve my part of the country. And so I was running a free clinic. And mm-hmm. then the Ministry of Health happened to go through town, and they told him there is a doctor who's doing this. He said, well, since you're doing it, we'll put you on the payroll. And so I end up working for the Ministry of Health mm-hmm. for the rest of the time. So for about 2 years, I practiced as a village doctor.
What was it like for you to go home, and how were you received?
It was, I think, perhaps it was the happiest time in my life, because most of those people that I administered health care were seeing doctor for the first time in their lives. And, you know, we're talking about 50 years ago, and now it's much better. But so with a simple medical intervention, I would save a kid's life, and there is nothing like it in the world, saving a kid's life. So it was very satisfying, but there was also frustration, because I would administer drugs, streptomycin, tetracycline, what have you, but I didn't really know why they worked. Why do you give streptomycin for this and you give tetracycline or penicillin for that? And I want to know that. And I think that was a main reason that I come to the United States to study, find out why.
So that's what brought you to Dallas?
More or less. In my second year in medical school, I was for the first time, so this would be 64, I learned about DNA, and I thought it was the most fascinating thing. And so at that point, I decided to work on DNA, and so that's what brought me to the United States.
You studied at Dallas, you studied under Stan Rupert, right?
That's correct.
So tell us what you did and his influence on your work.
Well, I was very fortunate because Stan Rupert is the person who discovered DNA repair. And so for a kid coming from a remote part of Turkey to end up working for a scientist who opened an entire field of research, it was an unimaginable luck or whatever you call it, but that's what happened. Mm-hmm. I end up working for the person who discovered DNA repair. And so
well, let me ask you about that. You say discover DNA repair. Did we know, or when did we realize that DNA was in fact had a repair mechanism?
So, for a very long time, it has been known that ultraviolet light kills bacteria, inactivates. Mm-hmm. You can use it for sterilizing a surface by killing all bacteria. That had been known for a very long time. In 1949. A scientist by the name Kölner at Brandeis, he discovered that if you irradiate cells with bacteria with UV light and then give them a blue light pulse, you resurrect them from dead.
So ultraviolet kills, blue light...
Right, resurrects. Wow. Resurrection, not in the religious, but more.
No, but it
less,
must have been a near religious experience to discover.
It was close to it, and
sure.
it actually created both a philosophical and physical question. And the physical question, we won't go into philosophical, but the physical aspect if it was, ultraviolet light has more energy. It's short wavelength. Mm-hmm. Short wavelength has higher energy than long wavelength. So ultraviolet light has more energy than blue light. Yeah. And so that created a dilemma for scientists, especially physicists, who thought about these things. How can a low-energy light reverses the effect of higher energy ultraviolet? And so my mentor, Dr. Rupert, who was trained as a physicist, like many physicists, got interested in it and looked into it. And he found that, well, it wasn't really directly reversing the effect of blue light was not directly reversing the effect of ultraviolet, but actually it was activating an enzyme that reverses the effect of blue light. And he did this in cell-free system. That's when you know you have an enzyme.
In what? I'm sorry. What kind of a system?
You crack open cells, and so it's not in vivo. You can study it now. It's not in cells. You're working with proteins now. Mm. You can study it, and so he demonstrated that there is an enzyme that repairs DNA, that ultraviolet light damages DNA, and there is an enzyme repairs DNA, and that is the discovery of DNA repair.
I am talking to Nobel laureate Dr. Aziz Sanjar today on the state of things. Teaches at UNC Chapel Hill, shares the Nobel Prize in Chemistry this year with two others. So in a way, we're not bringing the bacteria back to life, and in fact, we're activating a repair system that's going and fixing it.
So that's right.
So that's
correct.
That might help hold off the philosophical troubles
for
a little while. So talk about you coming to Dallas now and doing bench work and working alongside Americans. What was that like for you?
It was like most American labs. It was an international lab. There were American-born friends, and there were students, graduate students, postdocs from Europe, from Taiwan, from all over the world. And so it was a great place to be. And
You had to work hard. Let me stop you there because I want to get to the fact that we could take you back to Istanbul, where you sacrificed your social life for your medical career. Now you're in Dallas, and this is an important stop for you because you now have a chance to meet the woman.
Right. So problem was, in Turkey, we were given, I keep emphasizing, outstanding education. When I went to medical school in Istanbul Medical School was one of the top medical schools in Europe. And partly because of Jewish and German emigres who escaped Hitler to come to Turkey and revolutionize our educational system. So I had both Turkish and German professors teaching us the latest in science. So I really got outstanding theoretical education. But unfortunately, Turkey at that time did not have the financial resources to do experimental research. So I come here, theoretically I'm well prepared, but I'm really not good in doing experiments. And so I kept failing. And I distinctly remember my benchmate said, Aziz, from all our discussion, I understand you are a good doctor. You really are not cut to be a scientist. Why don't you go back and practice medicine?
We will answer that question in a moment after this break, when my conversation with Dr. Aziz Sanjar, Nobel laureate and UNC professor, continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Aziz Sanjar, UNC professor at the School of Medicine and Nobel Prize winner in chemistry this year, shares it with two others. So we've got you on the bench doing experimental work in Dallas, and you receive the bad news from one of your fairly not so polite but perhaps honest coworkers that you're not very good at this.
I just work extra hard, and I worked twice as hard as anyone else to get the experiments to work. To this day, I'm experimentally not that adept, but I come up with good ideas and ways to solve problems. And when I was working in the lab, I managed to do the experiments and solve them eventually. And as a professor, then I had students and postdocs who do the experiments.
Meanwhile, you met the woman who would become your wife, Gwen.
That's right. She was a graduate student, too, and we both worked late hours, and we would talk, and that's how we met.
And you were probably the only last two in the lab, right?
I think so. That's right.
You didn't have much experience with this, since you spent all your time in Istanbul.
That's right.
Well, that's good. So you did that. You worked together a five-year postdoc at Yale then after that, right?
Right.
What was going on there? What were you doing?
Well, first, let me finish the photolyze work.
Was that in Dallas that you were?
That was in Dallas, right. So Dr. Rupert discovered the enzyme, but he didn't know how it works. All he knew was it repairs DNA. It's protein, it repairs DNA. Proteins do not absorb blue light. Okay, so the question was, who's absorbing blue light? And he and many other investigators for decades tried to figure out how that happened. And to do that, you need to purify the enzyme. Well, he found that there were only 10 to 20 molecules of the enzyme in the cell. It was impossible to purify. And therefore, when I joined his lab, that was the major problem.
So you can't test it until you purify it. There's not enough in a cell to really do this.
Right.
This becomes your challenge.
Right. And so when I joined his lab, gene cloning had just been invented at Stanford. And so I went to Dr. Rupert. I said, I want to clone this gene. And he said, go ahead. And so I did. And I cloned it. And
thereby silencing your critics that your lab work and experimental work wasn't very good.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
That's right. So I cloned it. And my goal was after that to purify it and figure out everything. But after I cloned it, he said, you've done enough. I'll give you a PhD. You'll go work on other repair mechanism, enhance your experience. But I'll tell you about that in a minute. I'll just want to finish the photolyze work. After coming to UNC, my wife and I continued to work on photolyze, and we purified it now in gram quantities. And the photolyze work, the purifying, has been one of the most satisfying aspects of my research. Aside from the way it works, which is a really photo-powered molecular machine, it has a beautiful blue color. It's the most beautiful color I've ever seen. And so when the announcement was made for the Nobel Prize, that work was put as basically a footnote. And I shouldn't say this, but I will. I was not happy with that because I'm in love with that enzyme. And I collaborated on that enzyme many years later with Nobel laureate Hans Deisenhofer, who got the Nobel for photosynthetic mechanism. And I said, look, this enzyme is beautiful, yet they put in a footnote. Do you agree with me that was not fair to the enzyme? He wrote back saying, I agree with you. It is a beautiful enzyme. They gave the Nobel to the right guy, so don't complain. And so,
but your story illustrates an important point: is that science builds on itself, and knowing not only the theory and being able to imagine, as scientists must, how might this work, but then once I have that creative imagination, where am I going from here? How does this thing work? If proteins don't absorb light, what does? And then how does it work? I have to design an experiment, and I have to figure out a way to do what you did, right, to purify. If I can't make that step work, right, if I can't get in the lab and make this, purify this stuff and come up with enough of the enzyme itself, I can't get to the next point, which is the repair mechanism that you won the award for.
That's correct.
Yeah, I know. I think it's brilliant stuff, and I'm happy you're here to talk about it. And plus, the vision of this beautiful blue enzyme now will never leave me. But you did, so maybe you can explain to us a little bit more about how this works now. The repair mechanism.
The photolyse.
Yeah, photolyse.
Right. So this is a light-activated enzyme. It what absorbs light are two vitamin Bs, actually. Folic acid and vitamin B2. They bind to the enzyme, and they catalyze the repair reaction. Folic acid absorbs the light. It transfers the energy to vitamin B. And then vitamin B then transfers electrons to the damaged DNA and reverses the bond that constitutes damage to normal DNA. And so we've worked on this mechanism for 40 years now. And our last paper was published about 6 months ago. And we now can see the bond breaking in real time, and this is picosecond. We're talking in picosecond, and it cannot get any better than this.
So how does it work? We're talking about repair. When I think of repairs, you know, I have a line, it's broken, there's a bad part of my, you know, telephone line. You remember telephone lines?
Right.
I might cut out the broken part and you know, weld it together or something.
Right.
Is this, what's going on?
So when we talk about there are various types of DNA damage, the DUV in this DNA damage is just forming two abnormal bonds between two components of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And when that bonds form, then the DNA cannot perform its function, which is making protein or replicating itself. And so this enzyme binds to that site containing this damage and absorbing light and activating vitamin B2. And then vitamin B2 donates an electron to these two components. And then once the electron goes to the damaged site, it breaks those abnormal bonds, and then the electron comes back.
Wow.
And so the enzyme can keep doing it.
So it doesn't necessarily cut out a
It doesn't
piece.
Cut out. No.
Wow. It just breaks the gridlock.
It just
the jam.
What was the damage, it just reverses it. And that's why we call it direct repair.
And I think we should take one step back. I mean, the fact is, if you think about all the hundreds of millions of replications that go on, there have to be mistakes.
Right.
So we wouldn't be here if there wasn't a repair mechanism.
That's right. That is correct.
So, but how does it not work then? I mean, it seems to me that exposure to blue light would then allow every cell or every DNA problem to be repaired.
Why not? Right, right.
Why are some repairs not undertaken? And I'm now looking at the reverse problem. Not how does it work, but why doesn't it always work? Repair.
So it is light dependent. Hmm. You have to have light to activate it. When it binds to damaged light in the absence of light, it does not do it. And more interestingly, we'll get into it. Many bacteria, including humans, do not have it.
Oh, so we'd have to figure out a way to...
And to figure out the way to repair the damage in organisms that don't have it. And that brings me to my second topic of research after my Dallas years and then UNC. And so I went to a lab at Yale where this other repair mechanism was discovered, which is called nucleotide excision repair, where, like you said, it cuts the damaged region and removes it.
So tell me more about that. How much was known about that when you got
so
there?
So that was discovered in 1964 by Howard Flanders at Yale and Setlow at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And all they knew was that this is light-independent mechanism. And if you irradiate E. coli and don't expose it to light. So there is no photolyzed work. The damage, which is thymine dimer, we call it, the thymine dimer was released from the DNA in short fragments, in short stretches of DNA. That was all was known about it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, scientists were trying to purify the protein and figure out how it works. And again, there was same problem. The enzyme is not abundant. And because of that, no one had been able to purify and characterize it. So when I joined Dean Roop's lab at Yale, I was by then a gene jockey, and I was ready to clone the genes that encode for this enzyme.
That needs to be on your business card now. Nobel Prize winning gene jockey. I want to see that. So now you're working on humans because photolyze, of course, works for plants and anything that uses photosynthesis. Now we have to get into humans, and that's when nucleotide excision repair becomes important.
First, I did the E. coli. Human and E. coli have nucleotide excision repair. So I first did the E. coli. And found that in E. coli, it removed stretches of 12 nucleotides in E. coli, mm-hmm. and that was my work at Yale. And shortly after that, I was recruited to UNC and continued my work here to investigate the detailed mechanism, how damage is recognized by this enzyme system, which uses ATP, so like using fuel, either solar energy photolyze or fuel energy by this excision nuclease, we call it.
How does this mechanism identify the damaged area? How does it know to stop there and fix it?
The damage causes, depending on type of damage, slight or severe disruption in the DNA backbone. And the DNA scans along the backbone, and when it hits a region like that, it just stops there. And then it cuts it out.
It activates that. Right. It activates that repair mechanism. So now it's talking about actually winning the award, which of course came many years after you did the work.
Right.
What was that moment like for you?
It was satisfying. I think it was there in press conference after winning the award. I wasn't surprised to get the award, but after the medicine award was announced this year, I wasn't expecting this year because I was expecting to get it in medicine if I got it. And so because of that, I wasn't expecting it, and it came as a surprise in that regard.
Talk about the men you share this with, Paul Modrich from Duke and Thomas Lindahl in England. What was their contribution?
So Thomas Lindahl works on another repair mechanism where the damaged base, which is component, a building block of DNA, is released from the DNA, not as a fragment, just the damaged base is released. And that's why it's called base excision repair as opposed to mine, which is nucleotide excision repair, because in my case, a fragment is released. And so that is his, and he has made a very important contribution in defining that whole system. Paul Modrich, single-handedly has worked out the mechanism of, we didn't used to call it repair. We used to put it with replication of DNA, but it's actually a repair. And this morning I lectured on his work, actually, in my repair lectures. And we call it repair because basically it's similar in mechanism. And so his work is not on damaged bases, but bases that are in places where they're not supposed to be. The building blocks in DNA, A goes with T, G goes with C, while sometimes when DNA replicates, G goes with T, and that is a mutation. And you have to have a mechanism of removing that.
Recognizing it first.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Paul, who's a longtime friend and done outstanding work characterizing this repair mechanism first in E. coli and then in humans.
How important has this work been in finding cures and in medical research?
So in case of my research, the repair mechanism I discovered is not only for the nucleotide excision repair, is not only for UV damage. It is also for damage induced by cigarette smoke. That is what protects us from the damage caused by cigarette smoke. It's also the mechanism that cancer cells use to repair their DNA that's damaged by anti-cancer drugs. And so if we can interfere with this mechanism in cancer cells after administering chemotherapy, then it would increase the efficacy and decrease the side effects of anti-cancer treatment.
Great to talk with you. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you.
Us today. Nobel laureate, doctor, professor, and researcher Aziz Sanjar, who mapped how cells repair damage in DNA from ultraviolet light. What a pleasure. Thank you. Aziz speaks this afternoon at Olivier Smithy's Nobel Symposium at UNC, along with the two other laureates. And you can find out more information about that at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.